Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition here in the home studio, Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. Today, I had in one of my very best friends again, part of the Friends and Family edition, Scott Ippolito. Scott is a film industry professional, a long, long time. He's been doing this for, probably about 20 plus years, 22, 23 years. We met in the film business, and he actually met Emily before he met me. They're old friends. And he is a cameraman and a cinematographer and a DP, and he has been a director, and he's also a writer. Scott and I have written some screenplays together. He's a very funny, funny guy and great writer. And he's just a good dude. He's one of my oldest friends and like a brother to me. So it was very much fun to sit down and talk with him about Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And we do so right now. Give it a listen. So if I was able to talk to Chad Crowley and interview him, then I should be able to interview you without feeling too weird.
I think so, yeah. I'm going to try not to make this weird.
Well, put your pants on.
There's enough room between us.
And I apologize to the people out there for my condition, but I got sick in Australia. In Sydney. Yeah. I got some weird Australian rhinovirus. So,
yeah, I think it was the plane ride. I feel like we both felt bad after our plane ride from Melbourne.
Yeah. And if you're confused by that, my friend in the studio met me in Australia, because that's what friends do.
Oh, we're already live.
Yeah, we've been recording. I'll find an entry point. This may not even make it in. Who knows? I might wait next week till I feel better and just re-record the whole thing without you.
Well, there is an app for me, I think.
So it's funny, though, when I was talking to Chad, because you guys have sort of similar backgrounds in that you're like, I sort of know your family. Like, I sort of know Chad's family, and I know you guys, and you're both easily, like, black sheeps in your family. And not to knock your families, but...
No, I think I'm the liberal sheep. I don't know if I'm the black sheep.
Yeah, but culturally and politically, you guys both, like, kind of departed and went your own way.
Well, I think that happens to a lot of people who grow up in a small town. You know, you go away to college, and you sort of become a different person. Although I was always, I don't know. I'm just a sensitive soul, Chuck.
Well, I'm
not that my family isn't. They're wonderful people. They just...
Sure. But you grew up in Columbus, Georgia, which I'm curious what you're like in high school, actually.
Complete nerd.
Okay. Well, I know you're in the marching band.
Yeah. There you go. Which is... now you're just being redundant.
I'm rubbing it in. And you played the trumpet.
Which I think makes you... Aside from a drummer, I think that's about as cool as you can probably be in marching band.
Yeah. Well, our buddy Jim Issa was a drummer.
And Jim is cool.
Yeah.
The heart and soul of El Cheapo.
That's right. But as far as like, as it relates to movies, because like I will have set this up, but for everyone who didn't listen to the very beginning, you're a cameraman, you're a cinematographer, you're a camera operator, and just an all-around camera nerd.
Yeah. I think you used a few of those terms loosely, but yeah.
Did that start in high school or before?
I was always into photography.
Yeah.
And always into cameras and... is this in the right place?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, always into cameras. So I think it sort of became a natural evolution. And, you know, my parents took me to see Jaws when it was in the theater. So I saw that when I was like, 7 years old?
Yeah, that was my question. Like, was your family feeding you good movies and good culture?
I would not say that they were feeding me good movies and good culture. I don't know that that was widely available in Columbus, and certainly TV wasn't what it is now.
Sure.
With the options. But, I mean, you know, there are hundreds of movies that when they come on, all I can think of is, you know, laying on the floor of the living room watching them with my dad on a Saturday or Sunday, you know.
Oh, okay.
I consumed a lot of TV.
Yeah. Well, I did too, but my dad, I mean, he was around. I guess we watched some TV together, but I don't know. I've talked to you about this some. I just don't remember my dad being into movies or watching a lot of, maybe we watched some war movies and stuff like that.
Yeah, those are the movies that resonate with me, my dad.
You know? World War II films?
Yeah, The Longest Day.
Yeah.
And then, you know, strange things like I have an abiding love for Abbott and Costello because my dad loved Abbott and Costello. So,
well, that's cool.
I've seen every Abbott and Costello film.
Really?
Probably 10 times, yeah.
Oh, man. See, that's great. I didn't get any of that. I think my dad thought peak culture was like the Mandrell Sisters TV show.
I believe we had a few of their 8-tracks. So
Hee-haw. My dad was all over the map. Like, our 8-tracks, I remember very specifically, we had Blondie, The Tide Is High, which is fucking great. Eric Clapton's Slow Hand, and that's awesome. But if I were to go to my dad today and say Blondie or Eric Clapton, he would probably be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Are those people?
I have a whole basically playlist that's just music from when I was a kid. It's, you know, Rocket Man.
Oh, yeah.
There's a bunch of Charlie Rich. No one knows what goes on behind closed doors.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know,
uh-huh.
My dad was, he loved Barbara Streisand, but, you know, she was huge back then. Funny Girl. 70s was,
yeah,
know, Barefoot in the Park.
I mean, yeah,
that was
for
her,
sure.
Her era.
Yeah, I guess it's weird. My dad just didn't, he wasn't a fan of anything, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't like, oh man, I have all the Beatles albums or whatever.
My family was not very musically, I would not say they were, I mean, my mom's favorite artist was Engelbert Humperdinck, so I don't.
we saw him in concert when I was like 6.
The Humperdinck?
Yeah, the Hump. That was one of my, it was one of my first shows. That we saw like Kenny Rogers, Engelbert Humperdinck, Bobby Goldsboro, and these were all at Six Flags when they would have the concerts.
Sweet.
The Southern Star Amphitheater.
Six Flags, known for its contributions to the cultural milieu.
You would probably trek over to Six Flags, though, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was you know,
yeah,
the high point of excitement.
Sure.
And we only went to Disneyland once, I think.
Well, we had Six Flags. We didn't need Disneyland.
Yeah, you know, and when you're small, I mean, even the Hansen cars are scary.
The little old-timey cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Disney World had the race cars.
Did they?
Yeah, they had the little sports cars, but they went the same speed as the Hanson cars.
Well, but you felt like you were in a... Yeah. You didn't have to imagine you were in a... Hey, I'm in a Model T, ladies. Look out.
Yeah, exactly. They give each kid a little monocle when they get on.
I'm high on reefer here.
What about your brothers and sisters? Were they like... Did you have anyone kind of feeding you a cultural pipeline?
No. I think...
So you're on your own?
Yeah. I think movies were an escape for me when I was a kid. The summer, well, I think it came out in Christmas, E.T., but I was 12. And the summer that came out, I would scrape together, you know, money however I could. And, you know, it was, you know, a couple bucks to see a movie back then. And
yeah.
I think I probably saw E.T. a dozen times that summer.
Yeah. That changed everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people who came of age when we did are, you know, for better or for worse, you know, marked by Spielberg. I mean, he was... You know,
in a good way.
Yeah.
Not in the Catholic Church way.
But he was a good Jew. Not a good Catholic. But I think, you know, he was, if you weren't, you know, if you didn't grow up on the Upper East Side of New York or something and weren't seeing art movies every weekend, then
right.
Your entry into art was probably through, you know, the more commercially successful films of Spielberg. I mean, you know, that's how I found out who Truffaut was. I was like, oh, he was the guy in Close Encounters. And I was like, oh, he was a filmmaker. And then I started watching Truffaut films, you know. So.
I never really thought about that, about like being a 12-year-old and the biggest movies were also good movies. It's not like now. I mean, some of the big movies now are good. I don't want to be like that guy and say like, it all sucks now.
But the 70s were a different time. You still had, I mean, the studios weren't completely owned by corporations then.
Yeah.
So you still had the old-time Hollywood executives who brought these people on board because they believed in him.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Spielberg, you know, famously, I mean, he would have never finished Jaws in the modern era because it was so far over budget, they'd have pulled the plug.
Yeah.
And I think Lou Wasserman, who was, you know, the executive who worked with him, was...
Lou Wasserman!
Lou Wasserman! But, you know, he helped make Spielberg's career. I mean, he's the one that, you know, sort of after Duel was like, hey, this kid's got chops.
And, right.
You know.
So nowadays, what would happen then is they would find that kid and put him on the next, like, Marvel movie.
Or a better example, they put him on the next Star Wars movie, and then they fire him, and then they bring in Ron Howard, and then we'd end up with...
I saw Solo on the plane, by the way. I did watch it all the way through.
Yeah, you know, it's the best Han Solo movie that came out this year.
Yeah, it's its greatest sin is its mediocrity.
Yeah, it's amazing with Donald Glover on such a high that he's so...
Yeah, he was good.
He rose above it.
I mean, he was Billy Dee Williams as a young guy. Like, he did the voice, he did everything, that sort of refined Billy Dee Williams thing.
Yeah. Spoiler here, I didn't know what to make of his seeming love interest with the robot.
Yeah, because she said, like, oh, yeah, he's into me or whatever. And that was, I thought that was the joke. But then when the robot died, it seemed like he was into it.
Yeah.
That was a little weird.
Works every time.
It was good seeing Clint Howard, though. That's the good. That's the best thing about Ron Howard taking over. You get Clint Howard in the Star Wars movie. And there's the one other guy, too. Oh, who was it? I saw another Ron Howard regular pop up in like a little cameo or whatever. It's always Clint and that other guy.
It's funny. I was working on The Walking Dead yesterday, and my buddy Deke down there is the A camera operator, and he's got lots of great stories. That's one that this is truly what I love about the film business the most. It's just the great war stories from people. Yeah. And he was talking about being on the lot when they were doing The Grinch.
Uh-huh.
And he said I forget what movie he was there working on, but he was like, I walked around the corner and I came across, you know, Who Holding, which is where they hold all the background Who's.
Right.
He's like, so there's all these people dressed as Who's, you know, lots of small little people dressed as Who's.
Oh, man.
He's like, they're all smoking cigarettes. They're on their phone.
Oh, God. If only for a photo. That was Mitzi worked on that, remember, back in the day?
Yeah. I think you and I were actually traipsing around the back lot there one day when it was going on.
I think so, because we saw Ron Howard that day, remember?
Mm-hmm.
All right, everyone. Mitzi is an old friend of ours who works in the costume department. She worked on that movie. And I did forget, did we sneak onto the back lot? I feel like we did. Or did we?
Well, we went to Universal, and then there's a gate. Well, probably not there anymore, but I mean, there's the gate between the studio and the Universal attraction place.
And it was just open?
Yeah, well, if you worked on the lot, it was sort of a known secret that, you know, at lunchtime you could go ride some rides at Universal and then, you know.
I forgot all about that. We walked around the Universal back lot and like little kids, just like we ziplined through Australia like little kids.
I would walk around on that back lot like a little kid today. I always say that I think being a camera operator is without a doubt the best job in the film business because aside from the occasional wars between directors and DPs where one tells you to do one thing and the other tells you to do the opposite, you're really just there to
you know,
service the story and compose a good frame. And you know,
I mean, you're the one taking the picture.
Yeah. It's fun to watch something and think, oh, I was the one who made the choice, you know?
Right.
It's not so fun when you're the one watching and you're like, wow, I made a bad choice.
Yeah. And then you're also kind of out of the politics to a large degree.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And as far as cush jobs, I mean, the people on, you know, being an operator can be hard. I mean, certainly handheld, there's pressure, there's, you know, it's not a cakewalk necessarily, but the upside is huge. And having been an AC for so long, carrying heavy cases and pushing heavy carts.
Seen you do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, those guys are unsung heroes.
Yeah. So going back to high school, like, did you, and I always ask people, like, the people that ended up in the film business, like, I had no idea that this was a thing that you could do, or I probably would have graduated high school and become a PA at 18. But did you think that was a job that you could have?
No, it never even occurred to me. I'm right with you. I think if we had grown up in California, when we lived in California, it's an industry town. It's like the way Atlanta has become. You sit down at a restaurant now and you hear the people next to you talking about, you know, their grips or their art department or, you know. But yeah, it didn't seem like any sort of a attainable career, you know.
So you didn't even aspire to?
No, not at all. And we've talked about this before. When I got out of college, I moved to Utah for a year, and they were filming Geronimo and City Slickers out there, which your brother was working on at
City
the time.
Slickers too.
And at the time, I had the thought, like, man, I would love to work on that, but. You know, looking back now, it would have been as easy as finding their production office and being like,
right,
hey, I'd like to be a PA. And I'm sure compared to a town of 5,000 in Utah, like a college educated kid who wants to work cheap as a PA would have been like, and you'll work as a local?
Yeah, they would have loved that.
We don't have to pay to put you up.
Right.
We can abuse you.
Yeah.
Welcome to the film business.
But instead, you just got stoned and went mountain biking again.
It was a good summer.
I bet it was. So what was your path? Like, what'd you want to be when you grew up? I don't think I ever have asked you this.
Well, when I was a kid, I was artistic. I drew a lot. And my mom, you know, she was like, oh, you're going to be an architect.
Yeah.
Which, you know, so I went through a phase where I drew buildings, you know.
Yeah, so, I could see that.
But I think the older I got, I don't know. Obviously, art is, you know, a big thing for me and, you know, been a lifelong fascination. But, you know, I think I was drawn more towards photography than drawing at a certain point. So
So you were taking pictures pretty early.
Yeah, I never had a good camera. I mean, I had like one of those Kodak 110 cameras with the long, skinny roll of film.
So you didn't have like, you know, my dad's a photographer, so he was into it back then. And I would get to play around, you know, when I had permission with like the Canon AE-1 was like his first good camera. And then I think he eventually became a Nikon guy. But I always had good cameras around me, and I was just kind of like, eh.
Yeah. I mean, who knows how it works. I mean, if I'd had one, maybe I would have accelerated my path. But then again, maybe I would have been, it's easy. It's right there.
Right.
And maybe the fact that it was something to attain made me struggle for it more. I mean, every time I pick up my camera now, I still think, oh, I love that. I finally hit a place where I can own what I consider to be the best camera in the world.
Right. Which is, what's your best camera now that you're using?
I have a Canon 5D-R, which is a high megapixel Canon 5D version.
Yeah.
There are certainly newer cameras and the argument going on and on what's better, but for me, it's
as good as it gets.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, the fact that the whole Canon 5D revolution is amazing. I mean, that overnight, every Joe Schmo on the street had a camera that had, you know, cinema depth of field.
And, right.
You know, all the image discussions aside, I mean, it was an enormous leap.
So, when did you, you graduate college from Emory? And then what was your immediate path from there?
Well, being a philosophy major, there were a lot of offers pouring in.
I'm glad a joke followed because
Bean Buck in that philosophy.
I just laughed at philosophy major.
That's well, you should.
Oh, that's funny. I think I knew that. I totally forgot you were a philosophy major.
Well, by that time, I had decided, well, I'll be a lawyer. You know,
right?
I'm a pretty good writer, and I was like, oh yeah, you write things and you convince people.
Sure.
But I looked at, you know, I had a lot of friends in law school and even older friends who were lawyers, and
they're all dicks.
none of them seemed real happy. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of work. So what brought you to the film business ultimately?
Well, I think I was just, you hit that post-college point where you're flailing a little, you know, especially if you're liberal arts. There's, you know, you're creating a path for yourself. Certainly not one is opening up.
Yeah.
Like if you were a math major or something where people are searching you out.
Right.
And I was valet parking cars and waiting tables.
Where'd you valet?
Oh, all over town, like the fish market.
Oh, yeah. Buckhead.
I used to valeted at the Emory Hospital.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was funny. Ted Turner and Jane Fonda would come in.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Not great tippers, unfortunately.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
And I love the Fonda. And
he reeked of Cutty Sark and cigars.
And shiny new quarters.
And Jane reeked of aerobic sweat and communism.
Here's a shiny quarter. Grow up to be something.
So you valeted, and what else were you doing?
Waiting tables.
Okay.
And one of the guys.
Applebee's, right?
Yeah. A storied career at Applebee's. It was try the riblets, for sure. But one of the guys who I valeted with was a precision, quote-unquote, driver. And
right.
That just made me think, oh, there's jobs in the film business. So I got an internship at this company that actually was Krog Street. The guy owned the whole Krog Street complex back then. His name was Tom Arcaraggi, and I think his claim to fame was he was in a movie called Grizzly.
Wow.
And he was a great guy. I mean, he was just a charismatic dude. And,
yeah.
You know, I thought I'd hit the big time. I'm, you know, working for free on like these MCI promote. Remember MCI?
As soon as you said that, I was like, transported back in time.
Yeah, I think they used to do
something. It was an early telecom thing, right?
I think telephone.
Right, okay. There was no com.
I don't think that early com was invented yet. But we would do these things that, you know, and I think literally they were, you know, burned on CDs and sent out as CD-ROMs. Like direct mail sort of stuff. And
boy, talk about coming in on the ground floor.
Absolutely. And I thought I was, I thought for sure Spielberg might show up on set.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. I remember my early days in the film business too. It's just like, if you're a kid like us and you love TV and movies, like just to be on a set and see a fucking camera, or the first time you see a dolly moving, it doesn't matter what it's for. I think my first commercial, you were on it actually, and it was one of those Colby Jobs with It wasn't Cialis or anything like that, but it was something like that.
Probably some big bank or something back then.
Yeah, or I feel like it was a medication or something, but it was just to see like a crew and like lights, camera, and action. It was thrilling to me.
Mom, they really say action.
Yeah, they do. And action. Everyone has their own method. They don't say lights and camera, though, of course. Because they're already on.
Yeah.
Back then, they used to turn them on, right? Was that the deal? So they would leave them off because they were...
Because they were so hot, yeah.
So you'd save the lights and then say, hit the lights. And some guy like us would hit a switch.
Yeah.
In the corner of the room.
Yeah. Or the old carbon arcs. I mean, yeah. They used to actually have lamp operators. They were so powerful. They had a guy who would like, you know, operating each lamp, basically.
Wow.
It was like this little stalk of carbon or that they would sort of, you know, they're sort of some gizmo where they're pushing it into the flame or something. I don't know. I know about these things nebulously. I read about them and it's hard for me to imagine. I want to go to like some old rental house and be like, yeah, the carbon arc. I see that thing.
So I think it's valuable for people who don't know anything about the film business and who might want to get into it. Like, this is a good opportunity. I talked to Raymond Carr a little bit about this, our bud. But like, and I've tried to explain before, when you start working on a set, you probably come in as a PA, and then what you should do from there is pick out what you want to do for a living by looking around. So, like, how does that work? How did that work for you?
Well, it was a different time back then. It was, you know, we certainly didn't have Marvel movies in town.
Right.
So, you know, there was an extended period of being a PA. There wasn't, you know, I always say back then this town didn't need another camera assistant, didn't need another props assistant.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly didn't need another DP or director.
Yeah, it was very tough to move up the ladder here.
Yeah, it was a very blue collar film town.
Uh-huh.
You know, you could make a good living at it, but you were going to be an AC for your whole career.
Right.
You know? I think
if you're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I worked hard to get into the camera department, and even after I'd made it, I think, you know, for the first couple of years, I was, you know, I couldn't actually be a camera assistant. They were like, oh, well, you're the camera PA.
Right.
You know,
that old trick,
which means we're going to pay you as a PA, and we're going to
right,
but you'll come in with us and leave with us, and in between you'll be with the camera department.
Yeah, but I mean, we laugh because I was art department PA, and you probably did some of that. But that's a good thing to do. Like, you shouldn't turn your nose up on that.
No,
because you're at least doing around the people and the equipment that you want to ultimately be around.
I think it's the same thing in a lot of ways as when you get an internship in college. I tell PAs when they, you know, they're always asking for advice. I remember asking for advice, and you want to tell them something, but
sure,
there's no one answer to anything. You know, just tell them, you know, take advantage of it. Now, being a PA means you can work on a commercial today, a movie tomorrow, a TV show next week. You can
and
be
then
on
Broadway.
A documentary. And Broadway. A triple threat.
But, yeah, yeah, for sure.
Take advantage of it and you know, go explore every department and see what your aptitude is, what you care about. I mean, grips are amazing humans. They're the ones who keep us safe on set. And,
right.
You know, lots of them are climbers and they're outdoorsy and, you know, they ride motorcycles. And
yeah,
they,
a lot of gearheads.
Yeah, when you got to strap a Steadicam on and somebody's going to, you know, pull you around a racetrack on a four-wheeler, you want it to be some gearhead dude who's been riding four-wheelers since he was five.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And we've gotten to do some cool stuff over the years together on set.
I would some not cool trade jobs. What I do for anything. It's not been an easy road necessarily. And
yeah.
Lord knows there's no security in it, but.
And you actually, I owe you thanks. I've thanked you, of course, in person, but for everyone, Scotty is who hooked me up with Ross Marquand for, because you work on The Walking Dead a lot. Sort of a, it seems like you work there a lot as a non-full-timer.
No, I don't really. Do you not? I mean, I'm not tough enough to work on The Walking Dead full-time.
It's a bitch of a job, isn't it?
That crew has my utmost respect. Michael Satrazimus was the DP for a long time, and now he's directing episodes, and he's also directing on Fear the Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that...
Is that shot here, too?
No, I think that's shot in somewhere in Texas. I forget. Uh-huh. Probably Austin. I don't know for sure, but, I mean, he put together a serious crew out there. Those people are warriors. I mean, it was, you know, I was out there yesterday, and, you know, looked at the first scene, like, oh, that's not bad. And then the second scene, I was like, you just look at these scenes sometimes on paper, and, you know, they always say, like, you know, the most expensive eighth of a page ever written was Atlanta Burns, you know?
It's right.
Like, you can write anything, but then you have
to
realize
just type out two words, Atlanta Burns. All right. That costs you fucking $200,000.
But you look at these, you know, you look at these scenes and you're like, wow, that would be, a, you know, a couple of days, if not a full week on a feature, but we're going to knock it out before lunch, guys.
Wow. And it still looks good.
Yeah. I mean, it's truly an amazing group down there. All of them.
Yeah.
Greg Nicotero and, you know, just that whole AMC crew, Tom Luce, who's the producer. I mean, those people they put together a pretty tight knit family down there, and they go through, they are in the trenches every day.
Yeah. That's awesome. All right, let's get into Close Encounters. I saw this last night again, and it just occurred to me today that I don't think I saw the director's cut, which really pisses me off.
Well, there's a couple of different cuts of it, really.
There are.
I mean, there's the initial cut, which I think it was supposed to be released later than it was, and Columbia TriStar was, as I recall, they were, you know, back then, I don't know if you remember, but all the studios were sort of in financial crisis in a lot of ways. They were they were booming and busting with this new blockbuster mentality, for one.
Right. Spend a ton of money on a movie, which was a big investment for them back then.
Yeah. And they didn't, you know, they didn't have it figured out now the way they do, where they can afford to spend all these. And if one of them hits, we're great. If two of them hits, we're even greater.
Now it's a spreadsheet that they can kind of look at.
Yeah. So they pushed them to release it sooner. And it's, you know. So there was the initial cut, and then mm-hmm. I think he got a cut afterwards. I think a couple years later, he did another cut. They wanted to re-release it, and they gave him money to shoot some additional scenes, like that scene where they find the big ship in the desert.
Right.
That was an additional scene.
Right.
And I think they also added, like, the interiors of the spaceship.
Yeah, the mothership, which I did not see that in the version I saw last night.
That's him. He pulled those out for the 40th anniversary, I think.
Oh, okay.
Because he wasn't.
Because he didn't want that. I did read that today, that they said, if you want to reshoot, then we have to see the inside of the mothership.
Yeah, and I've read it both ways over the years, where he wanted to do it.
Interesting.
But it sounds to me like it was probably the studio. They want a payoff.
Right.
You know, they're not going to spend two hours and 20 minutes and not see an alien.
Alien coitus.
An alien bedroom. This is where we bunk.
Well, I don't know which version I saw then.
It's hard to tell anymore. I saw one a few months back. They went and saw it on the big screen, and they have a 4K remastering of it. Mm. And it was just...
Where was that?
They've been doing these, trotting these out fairly regularly. They come out for like a week.
Yeah.
And
is it here, though?
Yeah.
Ugh.
They, you know, they'll be like on a Tuesday night at 7.
Right.
Like, all right.
Just like one showing.
And maybe they do a few, but it's always like, I always end up, you know, I see...
Yeah.
I see a lot of movies.
Yeah. Scotty sees... Not every movie, but you see almost every movie.
I probably see definitely a movie a week. Sometimes, you know, 2, 3, 4 movies if I'm not working.
Yeah, I mean, I would say if there are 52 weeks in a year, you probably see 80 movies a year, don't you? Do you count?
I have all my movie stubs for like the last 25 years. Yeah.
And I built a house.
it's probably over 100 movies a year, I'm sure, easily.
Jeez, that's amazing. Because you always say, you're the one that always says, you can learn as much from a bad movie as you can from a good movie.
I've learned a lot from Michael Bay.
I'd have a lot of respect for that, man. I like that.
Well, I kind of feel like, you know, if you're going to watch something, I could go home and watch it on TV, or I could go to the theater and watch it. And North Cab is great. I love it. I didn't realize that North Cab had become like a cheap theater. You can go see like a new release for $7.
Yeah, the matinees. I saw a matinee there recently, and it was something like $3.50. And I was like... Is this right? Do you think I'm 4? But yeah, it was a delight. Not that, whatever, you know, $3 or $4 isn't that big of a deal, but it just makes you feel like you're getting a value.
Yeah, you're definitely getting a value, kid.
So, Close Encounters, 1977, Spielberg wrote and directed. A lot of other people touched the script. I don't really know the backstory there, but he is given lone screenwriting credit. He was fucking like 29 into 30 when he was making this movie. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. I mean, that's
unbelievable.
He's a genius. I mean, you can debate it, but you know,
yeah,
certainly the first 20 years of work stands on its own.
Oh, for sure. So Jaws preceded this. I mean, this is how it went for him. Not counting Duel,
which was a TV movie. So.
Right. Which was good. But Jaws, then Close Encounters, then the big misstep with 1941.
Arguably not a misstep.
Well, I don't think it's that bad, but for him, it was a misstep, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was not I don't think it was a box office success, but no, I still love that movie.
Sure, of course you do.
Yeah.
then Raiders. I had him backwards. I thought E.T. was before Raiders, but Raiders, then E.T. So I had those flip-flop in my brain somehow. Shot by the great Vilmos Zsigmond. $20 million budget, went on to gross over $300 million.
Raiders did?
No. Close Encounters.
Okay.
And then starring, of course, Richard Dreyfuss back in the glory days when Richard Dreyfuss could be a leading man in Hollywood, which is hysterical to think about now.
Yeah, and it's amazing the people who didn't do the role in Close Encounters. I mean, I think Steve McQueen is the only one that always pops to my mind that he turned it down.
Was he considered?
Which, you know, you think about that movie with Steve McQueen, I mean—
Steve McQueen would have been great.
He's a lot of things, but I don't know that he has the humor of Richard Dreyfuss. And there's
I think he does have good humor. I think he could have pulled it off. He's Steve McQueen.
I mean, I'd love to see it. Trust me.
Yeah, but I just always crack up at like...
It's like the Eric Stoltz version of Back to the Future. I want to see it.
Have you ever seen any of those scenes?
No.
It's so weird. You can get them online.
Really?
Yeah. There's a couple of shots and it's like bizarro world.
Who knows? Zemeckis is such a genius. He might just go ahead and release a version one day. I went ahead and did a whole Stoltz version.
back to the Stoltz. Dreyfuss, people like Dustin Hoffman were leading men. Just a very unique time in Hollywood. Like today, this character would be played by...
Chris Hemsworth?
Yeah, exactly. Or whoever the ugliest Hemsworth is. I don't know which one is the ugliest, but...
I think there's a Johnny Hemsworth. They don't let leave the country.
Yeah, exactly. He's only an 8.5. Francois Truffaut, weirdly, I had no idea who he was when I saw this movie as a kid.
Yeah, that's what I mean. He was my intro to French cinema through him, you know?
Why was he in this? Did he act a lot?
He did some acting. Well, he started as a critic.
Oh, and, no shit.
And then became a filmmaker, and he was going to write a book about being an actor, which never got written, but that was part of what he says he was doing Close Encounters for. But
wow. He was missing his calling. He's a pretty good director.
Yeah.
The wonderful Melinda Dillon, the wonderful Terry Garr, like two of the most adorable, wonderful actresses of all time.
Terry Garr, I mean... Young Frankenstein, Tootsie. I mean,
yeah.
How many great things was she in back then?
I love her.
I miss her, man.
I think she got sick.
Oh, did she?
I think something happened where, like, you know, she kind of just disappeared. And I think she got sick. And that really, like, makes me sad because I've always loved Terry Garr. Balaban.
Yeah. It's so funny to see him in that role.
I know.
I think of him as, like, Waiting for Guffman.
Sure.
Woody Allen. I mean, it's just...
I didn't know he was acting back then.
Yeah.
I even forgot until last night, and I was like, oh, shit.
It's sort of like when you see Richard Jenkins. Like, he's become such a character...
Yeah.
...fixture, but I think it was that movie, Little Nicky, where he plays, I think River Phoenix is like, his family is like, they're Russian agents or something.
Oh, yeah.
But Richard Jenkins had the full head of hair. He was definitely like leading man back then, you know, but...
Yeah.
I would argue that the loss of hair led to a much more interesting career for him.
He shouldn't have gotten plugs like Ben Affleck.
Does Affleck have plugs?
He looks, I think he's pretty pluggy.
Ugh, poor Ben.
Roberts Blossom, the best known from Home Alone, is the old man.
Mm-hmm.
He plays the Bigfoot guy in this.
I saw Bigfoot in 1973.
And then other little small cameos like Carl Weathers. And it's funny, I was watching the beginning, that air traffic control scene, and I was like, holy shit, Gary Cole is like an extra. But I don't think it's Gary Cole.
Are you talking about the black guy, the main air traffic controller
who's
like talking to him?
No, the guy, the white guy who leans in over his shoulder.
Oh, right.
Is the spitting image of Gary Cole. And I looked it up, and Gary Cole supposedly didn't start acting because he would have been like 20 until like 7 years later. But I was like, no, that's Gary Cole.
Interesting.
And all these people are online and are like, I swear to God, that's Gary Cole. But I don't think it's Gary Cole.
Well, it's like the main air traffic controller, his voice is like the exact sound of Morgan Freeman, but it's not Morgan Freeman.
That was the other thing everyone said online, is that's Morgan Freeman. I was like, that's not Morgan Freeman at all.
Oh, really? That's like a thing? Like people are...
Yeah.
I guess
it's
that makes
Gary
sense.
Cole and Morgan Freeman are in a scene, and neither one of them are in that scene. He doesn't look anything like Morgan Freeman. And no. Morgan Freeman was acting. He was on Electric Company at the time.
Maybe he was busy with Electric Company, couldn't do Close Encounter.
All right, so the movie opens with, and just seeing that font like last night gave me chills, that Close Encounters font. And it starts out like silently, and then you hear that John Williams sort of droning score start. And then that whole beginning out in the desert, it really sort of had a Raiders of the Lost Ark feel to me. Or, you know, Raiders, I guess, had the Close Encounters feel. But it really kind of hit me that it was sort of became a hallmark for Spielberg with Jaws, Raiders, E.T. They all had this opening scene that picked up a story that was already happening, which mm-hmm. really gives us a good little trick to give you a lot of energy, but also very mysterious. Like something happens and you're not sure what's going on, and then it stops, and then you go to somewhere in suburbia.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like, almost like that movie is a couple of vignettes to start with before we even get to Dreyfus. But that first one, yeah, it's you know, the whole idea that your opening image of your movie should like sort of be the, you know, thematic of the movie, like,
right.
you know, that car sort of emerging from the dust. It's like, you know, this, you know, essentially, you know, that's what happens is like, what is this movie about emerges over time. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, film critique kind of, you know,
right.
nasal gazing in a way, but yeah. It's fun, you know. It's you know, it was art that came to small town America.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, he was just a kid, and he was using these. I mean, these are sort of well worn cinema tricks. It's not like he was rewriting the book or anything. I think, in fact, he was like firmly holding on to the book and making like very traditional sort of adventure films.
Well, I think part of the genius of Spielberg is that. You know, people often bash him for his continuity. He's sort of terrible at continuity. I mean, if you watch his movies, like sometimes things don't make logical sense.
Yeah.
But they make so much emotional sense that
right.
There's no point in even arguing about the logic of it anymore because you're like, it just works.
Yeah.
And continuity is not a, you know, there'll be continuity problems all over the place, but who cares?
Yeah. I never really thought about that. You're kind of right, though.
Yeah.
But like this opening scene kind of reminded me of that with Raiders and Jaws and E.T. Just sort of this mysterious, or I guess in Jaws, you know, it was the lady swimming in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there's always this event. And then it cuts to like what ends up being the heart of the story.
Yeah.
Or like the main characters of the story.
Yeah.
But it's really just a great way. Like, if you're working on screenwriting or whatever out there, like, just watch one of these movies. And like, that's your fucking blueprint.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a great way to get your story going.
Well, and Balaban is so great too. Like, I mean, Spielberg uses them well too, like, you know, when they find those old planes, you know, that went missing and
yeah,
everything.
Yeah.
And, you know,
they were reported missing in 1945.
They look like they're brand new.
It's kind of obvious, but it's so great. And then he just disappears into the dust.
Well, yeah, but he's also like, what's going on? I don't understand. You know,
yeah.
he's like yelling out what Spielberg wants the audience to feel.
Sure.
So it's like, you know, he puts the audience on screen almost. It's,
yeah.
It's like, you know, brilliant technique, you know.
Yeah.
It
yeah,
would,
for
it
sure.
Would probably be a little ham-fisted these days, but in 1977,
oh,
it was.
I bought it. It holds up too.
Absolutely, and then at the end, the way he just kind of recoils back, like, you know, he's like scared about what's going on. You know.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And then that next little scene in the air traffic control, which he used real dudes for that scene, but at the end of that scene, it's such a sort of an efficient way to handle things when they ask. All the different planes, like, do you want to report a UFO? And everyone, you know, because you hear all the madness of these Navy or these pilots.
This near
UFOs.
Collision, yeah.
Yeah, and they ask every single one of them one at a time. They're like, nope, don't want to report anything. So you immediately have set the table. There's fucking UFOs, and this is how the government handles it, basically. This is like fucking buries it.
Yeah, well, it's not even that the government's burying it. It's just that nobody wants to go on record and be... You know, and I think you see that later with you know, the Bigfoot guy. It's like Spielberg addresses all of those things that are on people's minds about, like, you know, if you report a UFO, you're nuts. Well, yeah, these guys saw something, but they don't want to talk about it. And, you know, and even like the back chatter of those guys we were talking about could have been an SR-71, which I think was like a spy plane or something.
Yeah, the Blackbird.
And they get on the phone and call, like, what are you guys testing out there? Like,
they
sort of run through all the possibilities and discount all of them in that little scene as exposition that that has tension, you know.
It's
wonderfully done.
Yeah, man, there's so much energy to it. And then you get your hero's entrance, which is Dreyfus playing with his train set. And I was thinking about, like, if you want to make a real hero, like, that would have been some slick train set that just whizzed around the corners, and the dude would have been like all self-satisfied. And what happens is the drawbridge doesn't quite lower right, and the train wrecks, and you see Richard Dreyfuss with his little schlubby, like, ah, shit, look on his face.
Well, it's funny because I think his son, like, comes up and he wants him to explain some math thing to him. So he's trying to explain math to him. And
yeah,
it's a very funny scene.
It says everything you need to know about that character, though.
Yeah.
Like, he's not some dashing hero.
And he's not a perfect dad by any means. He can't explain his kid's homework to him, you know? It's like he's...
Yeah, well, don't get me started on perfect dad. He fucking leaves his family. we'll get to that.
Yeah, that's certainly...
We'll get to that.
The elephant in the room for a children's film.
And then, you know, the very famous scene that really gets things going in that first act, the pickup truck at the railroad crossing, which is just like 6 minutes or whatever of perfection to me.
Yeah. I mean, just it's so well done, too, the way the first lights come up behind him and he waves the guy on and he yells at him.
Oh, my God.
And then the next light.
And then it floats up.
It's
such a good shot.
And you know that train track? They shot a lot of this in Alabama, actually. That train track
is
somewhere in Alabama. I forget where, but I've always wanted to go there. And
Yeah. Sit on it and have me take pictures.
Absolutely. Rock that railroad crossing sign back and forth.
Well, it's funny, too, because there are so many great lo-fi effects, like when the mailboxes are shaking and you can just see, like, right off camera, and there's some PA probably, like, rocking it back and forth. It's hard as harder, harder. But that shot is so great when that spaceship pulls up, and he frames it such a way where, like, it could be a car.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the audience is supposed to think it's a car. And then
it slowly rises, and there's another set of lights and another set of lights.
Oh, my God. It's just so fucking cool.
And when he looks up, too, there's that – I had forgotten until I saw it again. Like, when he looks up, like, he looks out the window and gets the famous half sunburn.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's these flashes and these, like these electronic noises as if, you know, it's almost like he's being communicated at, I guess, is what it was sort of implying, you know, like they're sending him a message.
Yeah, and he feels like, for sure, as a character, that he was picked – for this.
Yeah.
You know, like everybody does basically that becomes like the main characters. But what I thought was cool was it wasn't just him. I thought maybe the obvious thing to do would be just to make it him, but he goes around the corner there. And by this time, little Barry, Melinda Dillon's son, had run away.
Mm-hmm.
She had caught up to him. And there's all these people like hanging out that have seen this thing. And they're just waiting there with their sign. You know, that's where the guy has the sign, like, come in peace or whatever.
Yeah, I think
it's friendly.
Yeah, I think it's that crazy farmer, basically, the Bigfoot guy, the first night. And then I think he goes back the next night, and then there's even more people. And
okay, yeah, that's right. He returns. But
that little hilltop,
great.
That's where our two main characters kind of hook up.
Yeah, yeah. But that cool shot, too, of I thought it was so funny with the toll bridge or the toll gates. And the guy's, like, basically asleep at the toll gate. And all the spaceships cruise through.
Yeah.
It's like such a clever thing to do.
That's a quarter.
He goes, that's Ohio. This is at the Indiana-Ohio border. I just thought that's the funniest thing to yell at a bunch of spaceships. That's Ohio.
That is in San Pedro, oddly enough, that toll bridge.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We should go on a Close Encounters reality tour.
You could knock out a lot of them right next door in Alabama.
Yeah, we should totally do that at some point.
One of the things I loved about that movie, too, is it's so fun to watch the product placement in old 70s movies, you know. Of course, Coca-Cola
all over the place.
And later, the Piggly Wiggly trucks, the Baskin-Robbins trucks.
Baskin-Robbins.
There's I don't even know, Beacons? What is B-E-K-I-N-S? Is that liquor or something?
I don't know.
There's like a big box that I remember when I was watching, I was like, what is that? I was like, it really stands out now. But back then, I'm sure people were like, oh.
I saw some Budweiser. There's a lot of Coca-Cola.
There was a Bud ad when he was watching TV. Yeah, the jingle. And
they're drinking Budweiser, too, when they're partying and waiting for the spaceships.
The old ladies on the hilltop eating Kentucky Fried Chicken and playing cards.
KFC.
I guess they didn't have the bucket. They had a box of chicken.
That's right. But it struck me last night, like, these effects still look pretty good. I mean, I'll say this. There were a lot of movies made after this that looked a lot worse.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Douglas Trumbull, who did a lot of the special effects, I mean, he worked on 2001 and sort of swore off working for other people. He did a number of movies on his own that were pretty good. But he did the effects and like, the, you know, like the clouds, they use this big cloud tank where they would inject.
Well, that looked amazing.
They would inject like, I think like some sort of paint.
So is that liquid?
Yeah. It was like a, I don't necessarily understand exactly how this works, but it's like a tank, a huge tank, like a 700 gallon tank or something. And it like on the top is fresh water and on the bottom is salt water. And you let it get standstill and you can't really tell the difference. And then they inject this, you know, this white paint in basically in the freshwater layer, and the salt water keeps it from sinking. And that's how you get all those clouds. And it's the same clouds in Indiana Jones when they're on the island.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. You know. I mean, that shit looks good as it does today. The cloud stuff did.
Yeah. I mean, they shot all the special effects plates in 65 millimeter so that they were super high resolution.
So explain what that means to people. Well, including me.
Well, it's just a much bigger negative than a 35 millimeter negative, which is what they shot the principal photography, the stuff with actors in.
Right.
So once they married them together, there wasn't any optical loss of the special effects. They were, you know, more than enough. And even you look at Vilma Zsigmond, I mean, this movie looks completely different from his earlier work, like, you know, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, where he flashed the film. Like, he was more of a, you know.
That was sort of a blown out brownish look, right?
Yeah. He went for a lot less contrast than he did in this movie, but that's what Spielberg wanted. He wanted it to look real. He didn't want it to look, you know, like someone's interpretation of reality. And, and you look at the movie, it's so sharp. I mean, it's, and the colors are punchy and the blacks are black and the whites are white. I mean, it's,
I think one of the tricks to why the effects hold up too, is at least with the spaceships, is that he they're so bright. Like they're sort of, obfuscated by brightness a bit.
Yeah, they're lost in the flare of the. Yeah. And I think that was something else Spielberg wanted. He wanted that those lights to be, you know, 4 and 5 stops over.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, to really.
It makes sense. It's a smart thing to do because then you don't have to have all the detail. Like, and everyone's sunburned. So all these things, like, they're brighter than like Earth lights would ever be. So it all made sense.
And they did a. And then once again, it's, you know, Vilma Zsigmond working well with Trumbull as far as, you know, because he's going to add those UFOs. Trumbull adds those later.
Yeah.
But on the day, there has to be light on these people's faces. So like how bright are they going to be? What colors are going to be? You know what I mean? They work together well. That's like a good tip off lots of times in bad movies where you can tell the effects are plates or, you know, they've got their effects and then they've got the people on green screen. But then you look at the combination of the two and you're like, wow, that light doesn't look like the same kind of light, the same quality or whatever, or not the same color. Or,
yeah.
You know what I mean? That's, you know. Like you said, it's amazing. That movie's, you know, decades old and it holds up. Looks better than movies that come out now.
What is, tell everyone what a plate is.
Well, you would shoot on green screen and then, you know, these days we'll shoot the actors on green screen and then you add in the backgrounds behind them. I mean, like the Marvel movies are, you know, those are just all green screen, you know.
The plate is the base.
Yeah,
that you build upon.
Yeah, and then the physical props, you know, that people interact with. But
yeah,
it was like matte paintings too back then with Trumbull. I mean, it was, you know,
shit looks good.
I mean, I don't think there's any CGI in that movie. I think it's all practical effects. I mean, I think
it's models and matte paint. I mean, I was thinking last night, right in the same kind of wheelhouse, you had Alien and Blade Runner. And those three movies all still look great and hold up.
Yeah.
As a trifecta.
Yeah.
Which is really something else. And so many bad looking sci-fi movies came after this and still look bad.
I'm such a big fan of sci-fi too, and it's so rare that we get a good one that holds together visually, logically, story.
Yeah.
They tend to be kind of schlocky.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so we get the first. Just to nerd out for a second, the three encounters, who's the guy's name? J. Allen Hynek. He's the guy that came up with this in 1972 in a book called The UFO Experience, a scientific inquiry. And he came up with this ranking system. And he originally only came up with three encounters, which is the first kind, which is a sighting within 500 meters, I think, or is it 500 feet?
Well, if it's scientific, it's got to be meters, right?
I think it is 500 meters. He said basically anything outside of that can be, discarded as whatever.
Got to be close enough to make it a first encounter.
Yeah, exactly. Close enough to where you're like, holy shit, that is really something. So the first encounter obviously happens there, and the second encounter happens at the railroad crossing, because the second counter is it has to leave some kind of mark. So the power not working, the power's going out, the flashlight, which is crazy when the flashlight starts back up.
Such a great laugh, yeah.
Oh, man. And then his face being burned, like all that counts as the second encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third encounter is when you actually see visible occupants inside the UFO, which, of course, we get at the end.
Yeah.
And then later on, people added like fourth and fifth encounters, which go all the way up to, you know, things up your ass.
the closest of encounters. Yeah,
the closest encounter that you can get. The sexiest encounter. But he, I don't know which part he played, but he actually, Hynek has a little extra part or something.
I didn't know he was the guy who did the classifications, but I remember there was some like UFO guy who had a cameo in the movie who was.
I don't know who he played though.
Well, Lord, that end of the movie is, you know, a field day for cameos. I'm sure you got 1,000 scientists on.
Well, the dude, it's funny you mentioned that because the guy that played the iconic, you know, on the keyboard,
yeah.
He was the guy who showed up with the equipment to install the keyboard. And he was like, this is how it works. And he was playing it. And Spielberg's like, you're hired. And I mean, some fucking like close up shots of that guy's face.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
He's movie history now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, who gets a, you know.
So great.
A slow dolly push in on.
So he sees the shit. There's a lot of conflict about what to do at home. You set up this story at home thing where obviously Terry Garr doesn't believe him, but it's like everyone else is seeing this stuff.
Yeah.
So he seems crazy at home. And that's when he goes out the second time and the big party is happening, I guess.
Yeah. And then, they see the lights coming and it turns out to be helicopters.
Right.
Yeah. So which, and I think there's a great part in that movie where when the helicopters come in, he sees a road sign that's shaking back and forth just the way the railroad crossing was. And it's
right.
Like one of those great moments that makes, you know, of course, it's, you know, your character has to have self-doubt. So he doubts himself. He's like,
yeah,
maybe that's all it was the other night, too.
Right.
You know, this unexplainable phenomenon is now explained with a completely, you know, easy explanation.
Right.
Doesn't involve aliens.
I thought it was interesting, though, when I saw that party happening in the... And the lights first start, like Spielberg, he was so good at, and I guess still is, but so good at like faces, at shooting faces.
Mm-hmm.
And all these people are basically extras, but they're all those great shots. And even that one great push in on that young girl's face. And there's just something about like he was always just connected with the emotionality of people.
Well, he was in a great place to find him, too, if you're in, you know.
Mobile.
Rural Alabama. even today, you might find some Bigfoot enthusiasts.
That's true. Then
no offense. We love Alabama.
We do. Then you go back to India, where you have the tribes singing the, or whatever.
Yeah.
And you see the hand signals. And I love how he keeps kind of going to that other story just a little bit, just to sort of remind you of what's going on with Truffaut and Balaban.
Yeah, well, it's the you know, the parallel storylines of here are these, you know, at the highest level, they're tracking this phenomenon and here's this guy that just,
right.
It happens to randomly.
Or, yeah.
Well, not randomly, but coincidentally, you know, at the same time.
Sure.
But yeah, he's, you know, he basically is picked by the aliens, really, you know.
But that was the Spielberg thing, though, is to like bring a fantastical story through a suburban kid or, I mean, Indiana Jones was probably the biggest character, but he was just a professor at the end of the day. Like, you could have made him just a swashbuckler, but he also was like, no, he's also just a teacher.
Yeah, exactly.
At the end of the day. It's really interesting. I haven't seen many of his movies lately. I didn't see Bridge of Spies or... was it any good?
I mean, yeah.
I know you've seen every Spielberg, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I used to think when I was younger that you only had so many good movies in you. I don't know if
right.
That's true anymore. And then when I sort of thought that for most things, like, you know, music or whatever, you only had so much good work in you. But I think for guys like that, I think a lot of times maybe it has to do with the fact that a lot of times art is made under constraints. And once you hit Spielberg's level, there are no constraints anymore.
Right.
Who's going to tell him no?
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I think...
You need people to tell you no.
I mean, how many great things came out of... In movie or any kind of art came out of just the necessity. Well, I didn't have any more blue paint, so I used red. You
right.
know what I mean? It's,
yeah.
Spielberg doesn't face that anymore. He gets to do whatever he wants, and he's only limited by his own imagination.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, too, like, not writing stuff anymore. Like, he hasn't written in a long time.
Yeah, plus he's running a huge company now. I mean, think about all the distractions in life, you know.
It's true. Or maybe you just, like, don't make shit like you did when you were 27, 28.
When you were hungry, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. Music, movies.
What does he have left to prove, right?
That's a good point. So the government denies this, of course. You have that great breakdown sequence at the dinner table.
And which is just again, like Jaws.
Yeah, like these Spielberg moments. That's what made his movies so great, is they're fantastical and you have these big adventure stories, but he always like roots it and grounds it in these scenes. Like that dinner table scene is fucking heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah. Little son crying.
Oh my God. Like, especially now as an adult with a kid, like he looks up and like his kids are fucking crying because they know their dad is losing it.
Well, that's just such a great shot too. It's the classic, you know, tight on the potatoes and the camera booms up to reveal finally Dreyfus looking and realizing everyone's been watching him,
right?
Like, you know,
yeah.
And on a personal note, I mean, the cutlery and the tableware was all, I remember all of those bowls.
For sure. I love it.
I think you could buy them, like, you know, back then you bought encyclopedias and china at the supermarket. Like, you could buy the whole set of, like, you know, Corningware or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And we had World Book. What were you guys?
We were Funk and Wagnalls people.
Oh. Wow, look at you.
And then I didn't know any people who were rich enough to afford the Encyclopedia Britannica.
No, of course not. Fuck those guys. We had the beige World Book in the hallway, just right there. That was the internet.
For quick reference, yes.
The internet on the shelf.
Well, that's how they always knew you were cheating at school, too, that you plagiarized, because they could go to, like, three encyclopedias for your report
exactly.
on generators. And
oh, man. And then you have that great sequence the next day, of course, when Dreyfus is throwing all the plants in the window, and you're like, he's re-inspired. He wakes up and he takes down all the stuff. He's like, I'm done with this. And then,
oh yeah, the moment he goes the model he's been building and he tries to pull it down and pulls the top off and it goes flat.
The flat of Devil's Tower. And then he goes crazy and starts throwing all the plants in the windows, and it's just such a sort of fun Spielberg scene. With, you know, chaos, sort of controlled chaos happening.
Well, it's so great in the sense that, I mean, A, his wife is leaving him, but still somehow he gets to play it for laughs. I think when he like flies off the hood at the end, he's sort of like, you know, the whole neighborhood's watching, and sort of like, you know, smooths his hair back and walks into the house, like, or climbs through the window, I think. Doesn't he?
Yeah, like at the very end and pulls up the ladder through the window. And I felt bad for the lady next door because even though she was a nosy Nelly, you know, he pulled up all her chicken wire and her ducks got away.
Which I don't know that chicken wire was keeping the ducks in. once again, Spielberg, not realistic.
Right.
But it works. You forgive him.
What about the ducks?
Well, they can fly. They just choose to stay inside the chicken wire because.
Yeah, the chicken wire was like 3 feet off the ground, too. They probably could have hopped over it.
Exactly. Actually, one of my favorite scenes is the scene right before that when Terry Garr wakes up in the night and she finds that Dreyfus has locked himself in the bathroom and she, you know, old school, picks the lock with like a hairpin or something.
Yeah.
And he's in there, you know, in his clothes in the shower. And it's such a great scene because it starts with her.
That wasn't in the version I saw last night.
Oh, really?
Nope.
Wow.
So tell me.
It must have gotten pulled from, yeah. Like I said, there's three or four versions floating
around. I know.
Up this
so what happened?
Well, she wakes up like that. It's right after after the breakdown at dinner.
Uh-huh.
So she wakes up in the middle of the night and he's in the bathroom. Showers running, she picks the lock, goes in. He's like in the bathtub crying in his clothes, you know.
Oh, yeah,
water
that totally wasn't in it.
And he's like, you know, they're having a back and forth. And basically, by the end, he's like, he's, you know, got the bathrobe on him that he's wearing the next morning.
Uh-huh.
And he's like trying to, you know, explain to her how important this is to him. And it ends up with her locked in the bathroom and him trying to get in to talk to her.
Oh.
It's just like such a great.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, as a screenwriter, what a great reversal.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that totally wasn't in it.
Really interesting.
Because I did see that one of the versions, like, he added stuff but took stuff out, and it actually ended up being a few minutes shorter than the original version. But, yeah.
The time constraints were different then. A 2-hour and 20-minute movie is pretty standard these days almost.
Yeah, now like. Judd Apatow comedies are 2 hours and 20 minutes long.
We need time to explore the comedy.
Love you, Judd. Come on the show. Just kidding. All right. So, oh, well, there's that great shot on the phone, the big reveal of Devil's Tower when, you know, it could have been very easy and he just sees it on TV, but Spielberg saw an opportunity to play that for tension, where like he keeps turning his head every time they show Devil's Tower on the TV, and every time he looks back, it's gone. And you're just like, oh my God, it's right there behind you. It's so clever just to do, like, why not do that?
Well, it's such a fun shot, too, to be able to. I mean, once again, Spielberg, it's like there's no reason why he needed to build that model 30 feet high or 12 feet high in his living room.
Yeah.
But why not?
Yeah.
You know, it's
because it looked great.
Yeah. I mean, he always chooses the emotion over the realism in a way, and it always pays off. But it's such a great shot. You know, the camera booms up from the Devil's Tower on TV to.
Yeah.
And he has that great, great quip later on, too, when he's being interviewed. And they're like, have you ever seen this? And he's like, yeah, I've got one just like it in my living room.
Got one just like it in my house. Yeah. I forgot about how, like, mega art departmented up that recreation in his house was.
Oh God, can you imagine the art department building that?
Yeah. And he'd like got it from a bunch of like shrubs that he threw through the window.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. There's
and
some...
a trash can. A little leap of faith there. Yeah. How about if you had that on your resume? You're like, yeah, I was the guy who made that, me and like three other people.
Yeah. And with that on your resume, you'd get hired to do art department on another job.
Yeah, exactly. On Krull.
Yeah, can you imagine like the highlight that these were for people who were special effects guys? A lot of the, like not the, you know, not the Douglas Trumbulls or something, but
yeah,
you know, but like the rank and file guys who.
Sure. You going to work for some piece of shit after that? All right, so they make their way to Devil's Tower, the great sojourn. They get there and the government has set it up that, and there's that great scene where they're talking about what anthrax, like what should we use to evacuate everybody?
Yeah.
I can't remember what they land on. Was it some poison gas of some kind? But.
Well, there's a great, I remember this stood out to me when I rewatched it was, they're talking and I think on the newscast, they're actually, it's a rail shipment. Train goes off the rails and it's shipping nerve gas, nerve gas or
That's
something.
Right.
And the commentator is like, this is only the latest example in these controversial rail shipments or whatever, you know, they sort of place it in this context of like, it's just been going on. Like
it's like a government thing.
Like everybody knows the government's shipping their nerve gas.
Right.
On CSX. It's like,
well, this was, you know, late 1970s, not too long after Agent Orange fears and stuff like that.
Well, how else are you going to get nerve gas around? I mean, come on.
Yeah, by train.
You're not going to carry it in your carry-on.
What I didn't get, though, was so the government was setting this all up, and then there's dead cows on the side of the road. And my thought was like, of course, they're just putting them there to make people think that they're, you know, there's real dangerous gas. But then their bird dies.
Well, my assumption was always that in order to maintain the ruse, like you see the guy like leaning in the car to get the bird. My assumption was he injected it with something.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe he wrung its neck. Yeah, I guess my child mind always thought maybe he gave it a little shot to make it go to sleep.
Maybe he's just going to wake up and fly away. Maybe. No, he probably just snapped his finger around its neck.
Absolutely. Like an Appalachian woman cooking a chicken. He just wrung its neck.
So is that to be assumed then is that he killed the bird on the way back to the car?
That was my assumption.
Okay.
Was that, you know, it was all to maintain the ruse and, you know, because at that point there's that great scene where they're, you know, looking at the birds and they actually slow down and there's that shot with the deck and they both sort of look at each other and then put on their gas masks, you know.
Right. And roll up their windows.
Well, there's the great one in the helicopter later, which is such a great shot. I remember.
It's awesome.
I remember reading a story from Vilma Zsigmond about how they got that shot. Like Spielberg wanted the camera to move through the helicopter. And of course, we didn't have all the technology now, you know. So they took like a crane arm and a 2x12,
really,
you know, a piece of lumber, and Vilma Zsigmond laid on the board so he could operate the camera as it pulled back all the way through the helicopter.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't think about that. I wondered how they did that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you take it for granted now with all these amazing techno cranes, and you know, you can send the camera across the street through a window and down the hallway now.
Yeah, or drone it wherever the hell you want.
Yeah.
I saw a shot on Ozark season 2 the other day that I guess was a drone, but it blew me away. This boat, high-powered boat, flying across the lake, and the drone meets it like this and flies along with it then. But I didn't think drones could go that fast.
It's amazing what you can do with the off the shelf ones, but yeah, I mean,
or the boat may have, you know, it's that thing where it looks like it's really hauling ass, but it was probably going like 20, you know.
Yeah, 20 miles an hour on a boat, you know.
Yeah.
I mean.
That's true. I have to show you that shot, though. It's pretty great.
Yeah, I haven't watched enough of that show. I mean, I work at the studio that they shoot it at a lot, but I just haven't gone out there and played it all.
Brett's on that, isn't he? Or was?
Yeah.
Our good friend Brett, everybody, worked on props on that, on Ozark. After the helicopter scene, they take off the mask. It's a pretty great moment. He and Terry Garr, and now this new guy.
Larry or something.
have the most lo-fi escape of all time, which is pretty great. Like on this base full of soldiers, just sort of run away.
Once again, Spielberg, you're not going to get bogged down in the reality of it. What's important is they get out of there.
Oh, my God. And they just sort of dart through some barrels. And
I think there's a guy's like, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. They just kind of run by everyone. Who are those guys? And even Truffaut sees them out the window, and they get away, which is all that matters.
Yeah.
And then you spend the next, like, he really kind of takes his time. Like, the next, like, 10 minutes of the movie, I feel like, are getting them to the top of the tower, which fits. Like, it made sense. But usually you would just, like, put them up there.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to have one last struggle for your heroes or whatever.
Yeah, right? It was like man versus nature, though, because they're literally climbing and sliding down. What happens to Larry, though? I forgot.
Well, remember they talk about like if they can't get everybody off the mountain, they're going to spray some sort of sleeping gas. I think it was like EZ-20 or something, right. EZ-24, you know?
Yeah. What they used on the bird.
Yeah. The guy's like, I think there's actually a part of him. He's like, well, what's that? And he's like, same thing we used on the livestock. They'll sleep for 6 or 7 hours.
I missed that line.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. He was, I mean, that's.
So what happened? Did Larry get blasted with that?
Yeah. I think Larry fell behind and.
Okay.
And took the full dose. And
I don't know how I missed that last night because I was watching it and I've seen it a million times. Then I was like, wait a minute, where the fuck is Larry?
Well, frankly, that's one part of the movie that
they didn't need Larry.
That you could almost fast forward.
No, you're right. That sequence, it's almost a little too long.
Yeah.
To me.
Well, there's so much. Yeah. I mean,
there's helicopters, there's planes, they're struggling, they're sliding.
Movie with so many great things. That's,
yeah.
You know.
It's fine, though. I'm not going to bag on it. And then they finally get to the top. You have that beautiful shot of the tower and the base and the night sky. And it's just like, it's fucking gorgeous. And that tower's so cool looking.
Alabama's never looked so great.
No. That was Devil's Tower, right? No.
Well,
I wonder where that was, the base. Where did they recreate that?
It was in Alabama.
Oh, really?
There's like some... You know, it's like in a studio when you're trying to shoot something like that, what always gets you in a studio is how far apart are the supports. You know, you get to hold up that roof. So studios are, you know, usually engineered so that you can have big, wide open spaces.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes in Atlanta, we shoot in these like warehouses that have been converted into studios. And it's funny, like there'll just be a wall someplace
right.
for no reason. You're like, oh, there's the support for the roof. But I think it was someplace in Alabama. And I think they used to keep dirigibles there or something. You know what
so
I mean?
So that was interior.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that set like, you know.
Yeah, the base.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And supposedly they, this also, I can't remember where I read this. Like I read, you know, anytime I can find like first person accounts from cinematographers, I'll jump into it. And I think they were shooting like the train scene where Dreyfus stops in the small town and that's where he runs into the mother again, Jillian. Mm-hmm. She's out searching for her son.
Right.
So I guess she's been caught up in, you know, the army or whatever, trying to evacuate these people. They're trying to put her on a train and there's that wonderful scene of them running towards each other, like a love story almost, you know, like cross-cutting them running and then, you know, through the doors of a boxcar or something, we see them unite and, you know, but that's apparently Vilmos had to leave set and leave that with his gaffer and his operators to shoot
mm-hmm.
because they were supposed to go and start shooting the big final sequence and the studio suits were like, well, we'll just start shooting tomorrow. He's like, well, I have to light the set, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, he rushes off and starts pre-lighting the set, which, you know, of course, with all those bright UFOs.
I'm sure that was a hell of a pre-light.
Yeah, and they're shooting with, it was like, 5247 was Kodak's first color stock. And, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what they shot Raiders with. That's what they shot Blade Runner with. That's mm-hmm. what they shot this movie with, the 100 ASA. It's not a fast film stock. I mean,
right.
The Alexa, which is, you know, the camera now, is 800 ASA base ISO. So, you know, just three times faster.
Wow. So explain to people what that means. as simply as possible.
I mean, could you just imagine being an actor back then? I mean, and having to be under those bright lights and...
So you just need a lot more light.
And not sweat yourself to death. I mean, I think almost part of being an actor had to be, you know, if you were a sweater, you probably weren't going to make it.
Well, I would have been toast, as you well know.
Yeah, I'd always say I can stand next to anybody, do the same thing, and sweat three times as much.
Yeah, well, I can outdo that even. One thing that struck me last night, too, was how, like, the setup with the huge speakers and the light boards, like, not only was it cinematic and cool, but it feels like exactly how it would have been done, like how the government would have set this thing up.
Yeah, there's all those great shots of the rows of cameras just clicking away.
And it all seemed really realistic to me.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like... I can't imagine it being any different now, almost. Maybe it's just so burned into my mind.
Well, they would go overboard today, I think. But this was like, it was hi-fi enough and lo-fi enough to be just completely believable.
Yeah.
You know, I think that was the right recipe, was to make it technologically advanced, but also, we're also just playing a keyboard.
Well, then, you know, you start off by making everything white.
Yeah. And everything else stands out. I really thought about that.
Like, well, you know, it's kind of like it's cool. They have, you know, these old Airy cameras that the astronauts took to the moon, you know, they're white. And they also like they're medical cameras for like filming medical procedures. Like, you know, you could have like an old Airy camera, like on set, we would have a black camera because you want reflections. But then in that world, everything was white because they had to be sterile.
And, right.
You know, the white's not going to hide the dirt. So a little smudge of dirt.
Yeah. How much did you love that scene of that bank of 35 millimeter cameras just going?
I love that. And you see the same thing now at like sporting events. It was working at the Final Four this year, and you know there was a row of, you know, 5Ds and Nikons like lined up, and they're all, you know, rigged with triggers, and you know, it's all digital. So they're just, you know, when they get down that end, and
they just take a gazillion pictures.
I still remember when I was working on the 96 Olympics, we did all the track and field stuff. Uh-huh. And we were at the finish line, which was, you know, amazing. I was lucky enough. I was a camera PA and the DP and AC, they were like the best guys in town. So I got lucky and ended up in the plum position there at the finish line.
That's fucking awesome.
And there was a guy behind us who worked for the New York Times, I think. And he had the first digital still camera I'd ever seen. Mm-hmm. And he took a picture of, what's his name? Michael Johnson. I think he won the 200 meters. He was the guy who used to wear the gold shoes.
Yeah.
He took a picture, showed it to us, and then he somehow magically put it on his computer and sent it somewhere.
Wow.
And then that was the picture on the front page of all the papers the next day.
God, that's so funny how, like, that was fucking future.
Yeah, cutting edge. That was the last Olympics they shot on film. We were shooting film.
Man. And who'd you work on that with?
That's where I met your wife.
That's right. Everybody. Emily and Scotty knew each other before I did, even.
We did.
How about that?
We did.
And I was lucky enough to end up with her. So another scene that I like there, another shot was when, you know, when the thing finally talks back is after, you know, they're playing the thing in a loop and it's not talking back. What gets them to talk back is when Truffaut marches out there and like beckons the thing. He marches right up to the end of the ramp and just like shakes his hands at the thing. And that's when it, you know, starts finally talking back musically.
Yeah.
And that iconic, you know, I think they tried a ton of different arrangements of notes, and that's the one that John Williams and Spielberg went with.
Oh, and it's such a great, you know, motif throughout the movie. I think there's a scene where where Balaban figures out that the message from space is coordinates, and they figure out Devil's Tower and everything. Yeah. At the end of that scene, Truffaut he's at the keyboard and he's making the sound, and then you cut to you cut to Barry, the little kid, and he's playing the same thing on his xylophone.
Yeah.
I think there's a scene later on where someone's on the phone and the tone starts coming through the phone. It's, you know.
I don't know if you remember, but that became like part of the cultural zeitgeist, that tone, that sound. Like I remember, I don't even think I saw this. I was only 6 years old, so I didn't see it till later, but I remember like running around and singing that. It's so funny.
Well, I always wish somebody would do like TV Land would do, like not just like reruns, but like they'd show a whole night of TV from 1975.
Yeah.
Like show the lineup, show the commercials, show the newscast. You know what I mean? That would be so much fun to see. Cause I bet that jingle was in a million commercials in the late 70s and 80s.
Awesome. Then we get the mothership, finally, the big entrance. All the ships come in, and you think, as an audience member, like, oh, like, this is it, this is it.
Yeah, they all sort of leave for a second, and everybody's congratulating themselves. I'm like,
yeah, they all applaud, and they're like, all right, that's the thing. But it's a very, like, effective little filmmaking trick, I think, to be like, oh, no, no.
There's an encore.
Yeah, there's an encore. And that's when the mothership comes, and the mothership really holds up well. I mean, that shit looks great.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It looks really good.
Can't go right, wrong with a bunch of shiny lights.
Yeah, and models. And you get a little more detail, like it's less blown out. And the detail looks good. But that's when they had that great scene, you know, that really playful scene where they push the keyboard up and they start playing with each other. And I imagine John Williams just had so much fun. I'm just trying to picture him like a kid in a candy store writing about, like, a spaceship talking through, like, I don't even know what it is, oboes and tubas or...
Yeah, I guess probably the whole orchestra.
Yeah.
That's I imagine it was probably an idea that had a lot of currency at the time. And it was probably somebody like Asimov or somebody who was like, we'll probably communicate musically. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. The universal language of music.
Yes. It will be tones, familiar tones.
Yeah. I wish I understood more about music. They're talking about like the scale they're using or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not smart enough musically to know if all that was accurate.
Come on, band guy. Trumpet guy. And then finally, you know, it lands, the flyboys exit. And that's such a great moment, you know, just to tie everything back together.
The planes they found at the opening of the movie, now the pilots are here.
The pilots are here. They all have that just been banal probed look on their face. And it's that payoff is so great, man, when they go over to the big board, you know, they have the list of all those missing people over the years and they just start chalking them off one by one.
Oh, yeah. All those,
so
all,
cool.
All those great, like, it was like slide film or pictures of them, and they're like,
it's like a light wall
and a big Sharpie or whatever was the thing back then.
So great. And, you know, that could have been the end of the movie. Of course, Barry comes out, which seeing this movie now with a kid, it was just like gut-wrenching to see him get reunited with mom.
Yeah.
Whereas before I was just like, oh, great, there's the kid. And now I'm just like, oh, my God.
Barry, I love you.
Barry's back. Have you seen that guy today?
Uh-uh. Does he?
He looks just, I mean.
Did he do okay? He doesn't look like a.
No, he looks great. He looks like a little. He looks like he works at a bank or something in Indiana.
Yeah, good for him.
It's great. Yeah, those are the worst when you pull him up and he's got like ear gauges and like tattooed face. No offense to anyone out there. Nothing wrong with that.
Well, it's so great at the ending too. It's like, you know, there's that, well, the whole thing of them ending on helicopter, all those people were brought to that base by Truffaut because he, you know, he tells the helicopter to wait 5 more minutes because he goes in and he pleads the case to the general to let these people come.
Like, yeah, yeah.
He understands that they've been contacted in some way and that they should be there.
Yeah, he's not anti-Dreyfus.
Yeah, if they want to make contact with these people, then let's bring the people that they invited and, you know. But there's the scene of, like, I think after they're in the desert and they, you know, they have all the audio guys recording, you know, the people chanting the
Yeah.
And then they're playing it back at that conference. They cut from that to the conference. And everybody's clapping like, oh, what an astounding discovery. You know what I mean? But in that one, you see off to the side, you see like there's 12 people, which I counted one time because I was like, I wonder if that's significant. There's 12 people.
Uh-huh.
And they're all like, you know, back then they were in these yellow jackets. They look like Century 21 reorders or something. But they're the same 12 people later. They get marched out in the red jumpsuits.
Oh.
And you can tell it's the same people because there's one woman who has sort of a blonde beehive.
Uh-huh.
It's absolutely the same people. So they're there at this thing where they're playing the music, and then they're the people that they march off to be the...
Oh, interesting.
To be the...
The volunteers,
the
basically.
Volunteers.
It's funny. That's kind of one of the only thing that looks really dated is those people in those red jumpsuits. It's like you've got these spaceships that still hold up, but then it's like, let me put on my red jumper.
I'm dressed like Evel Knievel because it's modern times.
It's like wardrobe is what makes this thing look dated. It's really funny.
They'd have been better off in blockbuster khakis and blue shirts.
Well, and then that's the big moment, you know, that the door opens and the Slender Man comes out. And again, he like kind of obfuscates the detail enough. Like, it's a really smart thing to do to just backlight the hell out of it and like...
Yeah, just silhouettes.
Yeah. And then the little dudes come out and you know, they're little space guys.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a great payoff. I don't think when I first saw it, I don't think I ever thought that I would see that. Like, nah, like he's not going to show anything like that. I thought the mothership was just going to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. But I didn't. I mean, you know, I think we take it for granted now that that's what an alien. I mean, there was that, I guess that span of 70s and 80s where, you know,
yeah,
that's what an alien looked like. It was going to be a little bulbous headed.
Yeah. They're like 3.5 feet tall, no clothes, big head, big eyes.
Yeah. No need for clothes.
Big black eyes. Eyes roll back.
Like a baby doll's eyes.
And then that look on Truffaut's face, I never realized either until last night that it's envy. He's looking, like I never could parse it out, but when I was looking at it last night, I was like, that's envy. He wants to go.
You think so?
I totally think so.
I guess I read it more as like happiness.
Like job well done.
In a sense that he was able to get Dreyfus there. Because when those, because when they come out, they walk down that whole line of red-suited volunteers. And
yeah,
they go to Dreyfus and take his hands immediately and pull him aside. Like,
oh, yeah, and they start checking him out.
He's the one we want, you know?
Yeah, like, what's your jumper size? What size jumpsuit do you wear?
Did these come in extra small and really skinny?
Yeah, he's like, I'm a medium stubby. Do you have that? It's like, sure, it's 1976. And that's it. You know, he boards the mothership. And then it floats away like a big, beautiful ELO album. Although, in another version, you get to see the interior, like we were talking about, which I did not see.
Well, and I think this comes back to the point that you made earlier, that he does leave his family.
Well, that bothered me yesterday, like it had never bothered me before.
Well, and it's weird.
He leaves his wife and three children.
And
kisses Melinda Dillon.
Yeah, and he shares that look at Melinda at the end when he looks back at her, and it's almost like he's saying goodbye to his family in a sense. Like that's the last person on Earth that he sees any kind of connection to.
Yeah,
it's I mean,
it's tough though.
Do you forgive Dreyfus or not? You know,
I don't know, man, because I don't think it's supposed to come across that way. It's like this sort of triumphant, big, wonderful ending. But as now a grown up with a wife and kid, all I could think about is, where is Terry Garr and those three kids? And why? I'm sure they're devastated.
Yeah, he was like, what, an electric? He worked for the power company and got fired.
Uh-huh.
And so now his wife has three kids and, you know, wherever, Muncie, Indiana.
A wrecked house.
Yeah, thanks.
With the Devil's Tower recreation in
thanks
the middle of it.
Thanks for leaving a mess.
Ducks everywhere.
Yeah, the follow-up movie would be rather depressing.
It would be. But it bothered me that he
Close
was...
Close Encounters with Poverty, the first kind.
He was just like happy, like, all right, here I go on my adventure. But I was just like, man, that's not quite right. It never hit me like that before, so.
Yeah, it was the 70s, man. It was a different time, you know?
Yeah.
Love, you know?
I know. I'm missing the point.
No, I trust me, that when I saw it again years later, I thought to myself, like, wow, he just ditched his family.
Yeah. You know?
But, you know, maybe he comes back in 30 years and marches off the plane all young and Terry Garr's happy to see him. I don't know.
I doubt it. No, she's living with Michael Keaton.
She's
Mr. Mom.
She's running the tuna fish account.
Oh, God, Martin Mull. He's so good in that movie. All right, we finish up, Scotty. I'm not going to do the full Ebert thing, so I couldn't find a good pull quote, but he did give it 4 stars.
That was nice.
One of his faves. But we're going to finish with 5 questions. What's the first movie you remember seeing in the theater?
Jaws.
Goddamn. First R-rated movie you saw? Well, I guess Jaws, huh?
I guess that would be Jaws. Was it R-rated?
I think it was, dude. Or was it?
Probably had to be.
Look it up real quick. I'll keep everyone occupied. I mean, technically, my first R-rated movie was Blazing Saddles.
Oh, nice one.
If you count the...
I don't have internet.
If you count the drive-in.
I remember getting taken to the drive-in to see... what was that? I remember, like, hiding under my brother's legs in the back seat, like, to get snuck into the drive-in. And we went and saw that Orson Welles history, or he did some really dry movie about the history of the world or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Speaking of drive-ins, shout out to the Dromora Drive-In, Mornington Peninsula, Australia, because I'll post this picture, everybody. We were driving down the road, opposite wheel, opposite side of the road, by the way. Props to me. for doing that successfully. And you were on the phone with your girlfriend and you went, hold on, dude, turn around. I was like, what? You were like, turn around, go back there. Trust me. I turn around. There is a drive-in movie theater in the sleepy little beachside town in the Mornington Peninsula that has a full-on X-Wing fighter sitting atop the entrance.
Yeah. I mean, that thing.
A beautiful one.
Yeah. Whoever built that, labor of love.
Yeah. It was big. I mean, it wasn't to scale, but it was probably half size.
Yeah. It was enormous.
It was large.
Yeah. It was halfway through, somebody definitely went, man, what did I start?
I know. God, I'll post a picture of that, everyone. The only downside was is that it was Wednesday and we were leaving the next day and the drive-in didn't start till Thursdays.
Yeah, the whole notion of a drive-in theater alongside the ocean, I had never really considered it before, but yeah.
Well, the Meg was playing. I was like, oh man, I can't imagine it. Seeing the Meg, even though you said it was terrible.
It was not good.
All right, number three, I know the answer, but do you walk out of a bad movie?
Years ago, I would have said no, never, but the older I've gotten, yeah. Well, and lots of times I will go see a bad movie knowing that it's bad, and then I'm just going to
see a bit of it.
Yeah, watch the first 20 minutes, and then the movie I really want to see starts a half hour later. And perfect.
Still came in the system. What was the last one you walked out on? Do you remember?
Last one I walked out. Should have been The Meg. But interestingly enough, the last one I walked out on was Happy Time Murders.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of one joke. I mean, I'll eventually see the rest of it. But
do you know a movie we haven't talked about this yet you didn't like recently that I thought was really good was Hostiles. I love that movie.
You know, it was on the plane and I thought about watching it a couple times, but that was not the ideal. I really want to give it a try since you liked it so much. There was just that scene in the desert where when a director does a scene where someone's like screaming out at the, like Christian Bale's like screaming out like in anger that he has to escort this man he wants to kill.
Yeah.
And it's just shot after shot, just like they shot the scene 60 times and they just edited together
Did
parts
they cut
of 60
different
takes.
Angles of him going, oh.
It just seems so, I mean, All that right. just seems like lazy filmmaking to me.
Hey, I know you, buddy. You the littlest thing can throw you off and then that movie is dead. All right, Happy Time Murders, you walked out of. So.
No offense, Melissa McCarthy. I thought she was wonderful.
She is great. Number four, I will say, since you're a cinematographer, what is the most beautiful movie you've ever seen? Or cinematically, what is your favorite film of all time?
I don't know.
I know that's tough.
It's hard to pick a favorite movie, I think, just because I see so many and it's ever-changing. I mean, for a long time, Jaws was my favorite movie.
I mean, the look of it, the photography.
Well, you know, I think a lot of you know, people would say something like Days of Heaven or something. It's just amazing because it's all shot at magic hour.
Right. But, Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I there are different movies. Lawrence of Arabia is a beautiful movie. I mean, this Close Encounters is a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it would probably just be based on my taste. And I do tend to prefer a more contrasting image, sort of like Close Encounters. But,
all right.
You know, doing it for a job, you got to be able to do whatever somebody else wants. I mean, Vomo Zsigmond wouldn't have wanted to shoot this movie this way, but he shot
right.
it that way because that's what Spielberg wanted. So he just had to be able to do whatever people want. But I don't know. I guess I tend to enjoy a rich color palette. And,
all right.
You know.
Cop out. I'll take it. I'll take it. Roger Deakin? Roger Deakins? Deakins.
Yeah.
Roger Deakin was in Queen, I think. John Deakin was in Queen.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Maybe I am jet lagged.
When you call me a cinematographer, I say you use that term loosely.
Oh, come on.
I'm a guy with a camera.
Come on. And then finally, Movie Going 101. I know this as well, but because we go to a lot of movies together. What's your jam at the movies? Where do you sit and what do you get at the old refreshment counter?
I used to be a Coke and popcorn guy, but I quit drinking Coke and popcorn's no fun on its own. So I kind of do nothing now.
Yeah.
But definitely, you know. Want to sit right in the middle and try and maximize the screen so that it fills my field of vision and I'm not looking at exit signs off to either left or right, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want anything else bright in the frame. Yeah. But.
I will also tell people that you are one of the most skilled half-look people, annoyed half-look that I've ever seen in a theater when someone is texting or on the phone. the old half turn, like, are you fucking serious? Look, you're a master, my friend.
Well, I mean, you know, you got to turn your cell phone brightness down if you're in the theater. I mean, everybody's got to.
You shouldn't be on it at all, but at least, for God's sakes, turn your brightness down.
You got to check sometimes. You ain't got to check your messages, but yeah, don't turn on your flashlight in the middle of the theater. And
I thought that lady's going to kick your ass. That was great. I'll tell that story one day. All right, dude. I think we did it.
We did it. Close Encounters in the books.
All right. Thanks, Ben. All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that one. That was good stuff. Fun to sit down with Scotty and rap for a bit like we do all the time, 5 times a week, like normal friends do. But it was good to do so in an official capacity here on Movie Crush. Hopefully he could enlighten you with some film stuff and some insider tips and tricks and knowledge. He certainly taught me a thing or two in this very episode. So hope you enjoyed that. Looking to do more of this, everyone. I think I'm kind of opening the gates. Might even get a listener on here at some point. My God, I got to figure out a way to do that. I know people have been calling for it. Why not? I'm open to it. So hope you enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun talking about Close Encounters of the Third Kind. What a great, great movie. And always enjoy hanging with my pal and talking movies. It's one of our favorite things to do. Until next time, definitely board the mothership, but only if you're single. Don't leave your wife and kids behind. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.